Welcome to Her Leading Story, a podcast that will inspire you with stories from amazing female leaders and give you some ideas to help you design a life and a career that's perfect for you. It's totally doable, and the good news is that you'll have me and our community of leading women by your side every single step of the way. Let's get started. I'm your host, Julie Artis, and this is Her Leading Story. Welcome back to Her Leading Story. I'm so excited for this week's guest. Her name is Susan Dennehy. And I'll just go ahead and give you a little bit of background about her, and then I expect she'll talk about herself more in the episode. Susan is a finance, administration, and operations leader with nearly 20 years of experience in higher education. She played an integral role in launching multiple academic startups and now focuses on the transition to scale to ensure long-term sustainability and success. She specializes in process development and improvement, change management, human resources, and manager development. Susan and I used to work together. She's a fabulous colleague, and we've kept in touch. And I knew a little bit about her career since she had left the university that I work at. And so I wanted to invite her on Her Leading Story to discuss what it means to be an operations leader, a little bit about how she got her PhD, but then opted not to become a professor, and how she negotiated for the very first time when she was offered her most recent position, I believe this past summer. I'm really looking forward to hearing what wisdom she has to share. Please join me in welcoming Susan to Her Leading Story.
Thank you so much for agreeing to be on Her Leading Story. I am so excited to talk to you about lots of things. But why don't we start with you introducing yourself and telling me a little bit and listeners a little bit about what your current position is, and we'll go from there.
Sure. I'm Susan Dennehy, and I currently work at Northwestern University. I've been working in higher education administration for about 17 years now. All of my positions have the common thread of basically running the day-to-day operations of a particular unit. I started out in a really small department, and I was focused on advising PhD students in the humanities. And then when I moved to Chicago, I continued that, but with students in the social sciences and was doing more career counseling. I spent some time at DePaul, where I met you, of course, and was advising undergraduate students. And then ultimately came to Northwestern about 9 years ago. And I've been in a few different schools and departments. And here I've done mainly two things. One is help launch academic startups, whether it's a degree program or a research center, or help something that was starting up recently scale to a bigger size.
Oh, wow. Okay, so your type of role is really behind the scenes.
Yeah, making sure everything runs smoothly. That's kind of how I think of it. I mean, my own professional mission is really to take care of the bureaucracy and the red tape and the day-to-day things that need to get done so that researchers can focus on research and teachers can focus on teaching and students can focus on learning. So that's how I see my mission and my role in any given department that I'm working in. You know, I have a very process-oriented mind. I'm very much a planner. I'm very much someone who thinks ahead, and I'm all about checklists and to-do lists. And if you're planning a conference that's happening in 6 months, what are the things you need to do now in order for that to go off smoothly? That's just something that comes very naturally to me. And so I essentially decided to make a career out of it.
Yeah.
Right out of college, I went to graduate school. So if I back up a little bit, I'm a first-generation college student. You know, my parents did not go to college. My brother and I were the first in our family to go to university. I went to a small liberal arts college in Ohio and got involved in the McNair Scholars Program, the federally funded program designed to encourage first-generation college students and underrepresented minorities to go on and get PhDs. Yeah. So it became a very natural flow for me to go on and get the PhD. And so I applied to a few programs and got into Berkeley and went there. So I went right after college without really thinking a whole lot about what else to do. I mean, this was before, you know, the internet, before Google. So
yeah.
I remember when I was in college and I was going to the career counseling office to figure out what do I want to do? They gave me a binder of paper and organizations and companies to look through. And, you know, the career exploration process was so different back then.
Yeah.
So all that is to say, I didn't really have a whole lot of exposure to like what kinds of jobs I'd like to do if I just enjoyed being around smart people and, you know, using the analytical side of my brain. So going to a PhD program was sort of this natural thing for me to do. And I went right after college without having really explored other options. And about halfway through, I realized this wasn't really right for me. I didn't want to be a workaholic, which academia presumes you're going to be and which you kind of have to be if you want to get the grant money you need to get in order, you know, to get the research out and get the publications you need to get a tenure track job and to get tenure. That stuff just wasn't really where my heart was, wasn't really something that got me excited every day. And I sort of had this moment where I thought, well, you know, I'm really organized and I really like to kind of make sure things run well. And so I'll go into something that allows me to do that. And so it was relatively easy for me to get something at Berkeley advising PhD students because I was a PhD student. So like I already knew all the rules and I already knew all the sort of offices and the procedures. And I have to say, like, I've never looked back. I've never regretted it. And I still have lots of friends in academia. They post on social media all the time. Every time they're putting their syllabus together and grading papers. And I don't regret it at all. It was really the right decision for me. And at the time that I made that decision, I think a lot of people looked at me kind of funny, like, why are you, you know, stepping down from the professor track, which was what I was on as a PhD student, to be like a staff member. And other people didn't get it, but that was fine with me. I understood it and it was something that made sense to me. And I mean, I've loved my career. You know, there have been challenges, of course, but I really love what I do and I'm excited to get up every day and do it. So it was a very good transition and I'm glad I made it.
Yeah. No, that's interesting because I think, I mean, for sure, as somebody who has gone through the PhD program and had members of my cohort also decide that being a professor wasn't for them. I mean, in my grad program, it was the professors were pretty supportive of that in ways that I think at different schools they're not. But it is, I mean, one thing that's hilarious to me is it is very professor-like to be like, why would you want to be on staff instead of a faculty?
Why would you want to be anything other than a professor?
Right, exactly. That's so funny. I know you went through like a lot of like the different stages of your career, but I'm curious how you knew, like when you must have been in your early 20s, right? Because you went straight to grad school.
That's right.
And then, how, like when people looked at you and said, why are you doing this? Like, how did you know?
You know, I'd have to say maybe, I think there's probably a variety of factors, but I think one of the things that worked in my favor was kind of being an outsider to academia. Like, I sort of wasn't expecting myself to kind of fit in the way that other people did. Like, if you came from a family of people who were academics, you know, I have close friends who were like that. They grew up on a college campus. That whole world was very normal to them. Yeah. It was definitely an adjustment for me. There are ways in which I felt very comfortable there because I love to read and I'm very analytical and I like to talk about, you know, current events and those kinds of things, which were not conversations happening in my home when I was growing up. But I never had the sense that these were like my people, like my tribe per se. And so to decide to leave it, I guess I didn't feel like I was leaving very much. Yeah. I didn't feel like I was necessarily giving up a whole lot. And I mean, one thing that I had known from, you know, growing up and all the experiences I had was that I'm the only person in the world who has to live my life every day. I wake up in my life and I have to live the whole day with the decisions I make and then go to bed at night living with the decisions I've made. And nobody else has to do that. Yeah. So I never quite had the sense of like having to do something because that's what my parents wanted or that's what my friends expected. Yeah. That's what I just never quite had. I mean, my parents were just thrilled that I went to college. They didn't care what I did or what I majored in. Actually, it was just, oh, you went to college. Good. That was the thing you were supposed to do. And so for me, I felt like, again, I didn't feel like I was sort of leaving something per se. And I also felt like I'm really comfortable with this decision. I just know myself really well. Like, I just know what I like to do each day. And a big part of it, too, is also balance. I wanted work-life balance. I'm interested in lots of different things. That's how I ended up majoring in interdisciplinary fields and doing a variety of social sciences. And so the idea of like committing to one thing and being a very deep expert in a niche area wasn't as appealing to me. Yeah. The ability to have a life where I could go to work and do interesting things, but then come home and leave it there and read lots of different kinds of books. I mean, right. When I decided not to be a professor, the first thing I did was go to the library and get a book on linguistics, which had nothing to do with what I was studying. You know, I was like, now I get to read lots of different things.
Right.
So there was an element where even immediately as I was making that decision, it felt very good. And it felt to me like I was going towards something positive. Like I'm going to be able to do all of these things with my life on a day-to-day basis that I'm excited about. It wasn't like it was sort of some black box that I had no idea what it was going to be.
Yeah, that makes so much sense to me. I think the image of academia or being a professor is that you just get to read all the time, right? But the truth is really that there is a pressure to become like really, really knowledgeable about one tiny little thing. Definitely earlier in your career, that is something that you really have to do to establish yourself. But it's interesting, like in terms of how like that depth is somewhat restrictive and that you just knew that and maybe the related piece about lifestyle, like it just wasn't going to be the life that you kind of wanted.
I feel like when I was in grad school, I was learning how to build the life that I wanted for myself. Like, you're a student, so you get to do lots of things for cheap. So like I went to go see performances for really cheap.
Right.
The Great Student Rush discount at the opera. And I'm interested in lots of different things. And so I wanted to be able to continue to experience lots of different things, you know, intellectually and socially. And lifestyle was a big part of it for sure. I was kind of like to think about, you have to move anywhere in the country where you get a tenure track job or where you're most likely to get a tenure track job. And then like your whole life becomes that job. And some people find that fulfilling and that's great. Like when I was in college, a small liberal arts college, you know, our faculty had talks in the evening all the time on various current events. And that was part of the social life. I wanted a bit more of a division and a kind of set of bounds, I guess.
Yeah. And yet you've chosen to stay in higher ed. Like what?
Yeah.
Is that by design or?
Yeah, that's an interesting choice that I'm not sure I fully understand. Like in a way I do feel at home there because very analytical and you know, early in my career, I would go to the talks and it was so much fun to be able to, I'm going to go to the talk and there's no pressure. Like, I don't even have to say anything because I'm not there to impress anybody. I'm just there to learn. And I love getting, you know, the various emails about the discoveries that are happening and the research that's happening. That stuff is really cool. It's a cool perk. I think in some way it was, I don't love change. So I think I started my career, you know, A, in higher ed where I already was, and then B, at Berkeley at the school I was already at. Like that was a way to like continue with the familiarity as I transitioned to being not a student for the first time in my life since I was 4 or 5, which I knew was going to be a huge transition for me. And also, you know, as I'm figuring out how to be an adult and how to be a professional and how to build my life. And so I don't think that's a coincidence. And I think since then, and there have been different times where I've left a job and I've thought about where do I want to work next? What do I want to do next? And I've thought kind of lightly about maybe leaving higher ed, either working in a different part of the nonprofit sector or even going to the corporate sector or for-profit. And I think for me, a big part of it is the culture. It's highly collaborative and not competitive. I've had a lot of jobs where I'm new and I need to learn. And I have straight up cold called people in another office who had a similar job who I'd never met and never talked to them, just called them up and said, hey, I have to do this thing I don't know how to do that, you know, people in this job do all the time. Can you walk me through it? And people do it. I mean, they're just like, you don't have to know someone for them to be willing to help you out. And there's not that edge of like, we're competing against one another for the next promotion and we're competing against one another for the next, you know, for our division to be better than the next division. Like it's not at all competitive like that. And I really like that. And there's no pressure with the sort of quarterly earnings and the profitability, which is not to say that universities aren't enterprises that have certain mandates around revenue. They certainly do. But in the positions I've had, you don't feel that pressure.
Yeah.
It's easier to insulate yourself from that pressure, I should say.
That's a good way of putting it, I think. And, you know, it's also interesting to me just that you said that you sort of don't like change that much, because I personally have been impressed with, as I've known you, watching you navigate, like switch jobs from the career at U of C to DePaul, and then from DePaul to Northwestern, and then within Northwestern and different things, and kind of changing it up every like maybe 3-ish years. Is that like,
right?
Do you like to go in and like clean up the operations of a place and then move on? Or like, what's that rhythm about for you? Like in a global, I mean, you don't have to talk about specifics if you don't want to.
No, I think in many ways it's been about trying to find my sweet spot, because I'm not the kind of person who would necessarily look for a job every few years. I don't get bored easily or anything like that, but I have been looking for that right combination of like the right people, the right level of challenge, the right sort of being valued for my work and my contribution. It's hard to find, you know, when it comes to those intangibles, especially, it's hard to find the right combination. I've taken something from every job I've been in. And I have to say, like when I came to Northwestern, I came to work in the law school to help launch a master's program for scientists and engineers. So the program itself was very innovative. We were developing our own courses. We weren't just sitting people in like a year of JD courses. And it was all about helping scientists and engineers be innovative in their careers. And so really an academic startup in many ways. Yeah. We were figuring it out as we went along. We were kind of making up our own rules as we were going along. You had to adapt. You had to be really flexible. That's the polar opposite of what I was like. Like personality-wise, especially when I was younger, I was very rigid, very rule-oriented, very, you know, this is what you're supposed to do and you're going to do it this way. And I'm really grateful for that experience, because it really got me to flex those adaptability muscles and flexibility muscles, and ultimately helped me learn to be comfortable in the unknown and in the ever-changing atmosphere space, which I think has really helped to round me out and really helped me at every subsequent job I've had. Because while I have whatever I have going on in my career, the rest of the world is changing really fast. Like we are just living in this sort of moment in human history where there is a tremendous amount of change all of the time. Right now, it's about AI. Earlier in my life, it was about computers being introduced and everybody having to learn how to use computers and then how to use the internet and then how to, you know, it's like there's been so much change all of the time, and so much you have to learn how to acquire new skills and get comfortable with things being different this year than they were last year or even 6 months ago or last week. So having a job that really forced me to stretch in that way was, I'm so grateful for it, and I learned so much from it. I think that's the most important job skill, is that you are unafraid of the unknown and whatever's happening next week, and you are confident that you can figure it out.
Yeah. No, that really, really is. And it's funny too, because when you worked with me, it was right before that job. I think that was the first job you had after. Yeah. And so it's interesting for me to think back just to the days when you were advising undergrads, and you were starting to flex that a little bit, if I recall correctly. And then, but that is like building a new program that's innovative that way. It's actually, like, I don't think it's super rare in academia, but there are pockets where it happens, right? And that is definitely a unique experience where you're like jumping into something that's just getting built. And it seems like that's also something that has served you as you've worked in these like startup research centers.
Yeah, it's my role has always been to build the operational infrastructure of these new entities or at larger places to help them scale from startup to actual, you know, startup to scale. And so for me, it was exciting to come in and be able to like write the processes and develop them and, you know, develop the kind of communication plan you're going to have with your students every year at the beginning of the quarter, at the end of the quarter, what have you. And so that was really exciting, the kind of newness and the ability to like make your mark. But I think that job was also like before that job, I had identified very much as being in student affairs.
Right. Yes.
Very highly student facing. My job was essentially to meet with students most of the day.
Yeah.
In that job, of course, it was very student facing, but it was also about, you know, building the operational infrastructure of this program. So, you know, what is our policy going to be around when someone needs an accommodation during an exam? Like, how are we going to communicate about that ahead of time and collect the information in time to actually roll that out when the exam is happening? Things like that. It became more operationally focused, and that was really like the sweet spot for me, like really what, and I hadn't used that vocabulary before. Like I'd never thought of myself as an operations person. I called myself an administrator, and I'm highly organized and I make things run well, but I didn't have a separate set of vocabulary. That's really what's used in the industry and what you can use across different industries and fields is, you know, director of operations, like chief operations officer. Like that's essentially the work that I've been doing is building things up so that everybody can operate smoothly in their domain within that unit and also allow it to sustain itself over years and years and years.
Yeah. I talk to a lot of women who have these kinds of roles and are interested in operations type jobs. And yeah. They might already be doing it. It's interesting you say about the vocabulary, because I think there is kind of a, like, they might already be doing it in the current role that they're in, but it's not called that for whatever reason.
Right.
I think it might be because it's less common of a term in academic roles. Right. It's more common in industry or like corporations, but I've definitely, but maybe less so in nonprofits.
I think in nonprofits, it's also that idea of you're kind of going to wear a lot of different hats. So you get this very generic job title, like business administrator or center administrator or, you know, student services advisor. Like, it's a very general term that honestly, I mean, I've done this where I've gone to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and typed in my job title to figure out, like, what's the national average that a person earns. And, you know, it's impossible for those kinds of jobs because, you know, they have director of operations or something along those lines, a bit like business administrator at a university, like what does that mean? So yeah, definitely doesn't have that vocabulary. And I feel like in academia especially, it's been very much you're doing a little bit of everything. So we're giving you this generic title, but then not necessarily following through on valuing that work the way you should when someone is talented enough to do many, many, many different things and do them all at once. And you know, you and I have talked about this, like the question of whether there's a gendered element to it. I was having a conversation with a female colleague of mine and friend of mine the other day. And it, I mean, I do feel like these jobs, these sort of taking care of the department or taking care of the unit and making sure everything is running well. My observation has been that it's very, very female dominated. And I think there's this sense of, you know, women take care of things for people, especially in a world like academia, where like most of your tenured faculty are white men and or male or white women. There's sort of this sense of like, there's this class of folks who are taking care of the quote unquote more important people or very important people. And then it doesn't get described or labeled in a way that if it were the same job in the private sector, it's probably more male dominated. The pay is a lot higher. There's more recognition of the fact that there's training and education around that, like getting a project management certificate or I was participating in a leadership program last year and they had set three sessions on process development. Like, how do you go about identifying what the problem is in your unit and designing a process around it so that everyone will buy it? Like, that's a field of training and expertise. Yeah. And it's got vocabulary around it. And that's something that, you know, we don't talk about so much. I haven't heard very much about that in my career anyway, even though everything I'd been doing for 15 years up until that point was like exactly what they were talking about, that leadership training program.
So when you took this new role, was it called operations or did you have to search on other terms? You know what I mean?
It's got that generic kind of administrator job title to it. And then the job description is like a little bit of everything. It's in a department that's really exciting, but it's the largest department I've ever been in. It's about 300 people.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, it's really, and that's something that, you know, I'm about 2 months into it. So I'm in that phase where it's like drinking water from a fire hose and I'm like being in an avalanche and everything is coming at me all at once. And I'm just trying to remember where the bathroom is and who the people are.
Yeah.
So it, you know, that's something that will level out obviously as time goes by. But that's kind of the big challenge I'm facing now is like, it's doing what I've done before. Everything feels familiar. It's just a much larger scale. So that's the challenge that I'm in right now, which is exciting. And also when you kind of change in that scale, there's more people and you obviously have those opportunities to lead teams of people. You know, I went from being earlier in my career, like a one woman show, as I call it, like I did everything. It was all me in my own head, communicating with myself, writing notes to myself about this is what I'm going to do with my checklists and my timelines and just me communicating to myself and then doing it. And then as I've, you know, progressed in my career, I've had opportunities to hire a program assistant and train them and supervise them. And then it was a few people. And now I'm in a position where it's teams. Like we have an administrative team and we have a finance team and those are separate. Whereas in smaller departments, it's like one person who does both. So it's exciting to be leading teams of people who are where they're at, essentially, when I was earlier in my career. So I kind of know a little bit about what they're going through as far as like learning how to do things. But it's also exciting to take on that element of being a leader and a supervisor and coaching earlier career folks. And I like that element too. That's not something I expected. If you'd asked me 20 years ago when I started my career, I'd been like, I never want to supervise people. I think that's kind of why I stayed in smaller departments.
Yeah.
But you know, there are some things that I used to do all the time that I'm so glad I never do and never have to do ever again. And then the new thing that's interesting is coaching staff. And you know, there's a way in which you have to have a teacher's heart about it. You know, someone's coming in and they're new either to your department, even if they're not new necessarily to the work, and you've got to teach them how you do it here and be patient with them and be okay with them making mistakes or not knowing, and then taking the time to teach them and show them and encourage them and, you know, develop them and cheer them on. And that stuff I'm unexpectedly really, really enjoying.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that is definitely one thing that I really enjoyed when I first became chair of the department, was mentoring new faculty, mentoring the staff, sort of working with people in that sort of formative way. It's very rewarding. It's also hard if there's some sort of, you know, conflict or there's some performance issues. Like, I don't know if that's something you've encountered yet.
Yeah. Well, yeah, definitely. This, I think, is true of management generally, probably no matter where you are, though it's probably gotten better in the past 10 years. But you're sort of like thrown into this boat of managing people, but you have to figure out how to manage people. And yes, how to set expectations. Like, these are our performance expectations. This is your scope of responsibility. These are my expectations around the timeline for completing these tasks and the level of, you know, the quality of the work that you will do. And I definitely had to have performance conversations and develop my approach to that and my management style and my communication style and my whole approach to that. I've had to develop that. And then kind of after, you know, getting into the water in a little bit, then doing some manager training where I talked about a little bit, or, you know, reading books. Like, I've read Crucial Conversations and Crucial Accountabilities, and I thought those were really, really great.
Yeah.
You know, because it's really all about communication. I mean, if someone's not doing well in their job, there's some kind of communication breakdown there, whether it's, you know, do they understand what your expectations are? Do they know how to do the job? Do they feel comfortable speaking up and saying, I don't know how to do this, or I don't know what to do when I hit this snag or I hit this wall? And one of the things I started doing in my last job that I'm also going to do a lot more of in this one is developing training programs and having coaching conversations with managers. So folks who are managing their own direct reports, I'm excited to be that person to help them learn how to do that well and effectively, and to connect them with resources and to be a sounding board for them and to create some community around that. I think that's something that's so needed. Some places are great about having manager training programs. Some places basically don't have anything and you're all on your own. It is a skill that you acquire over time. It's a lot of learning by doing. There are books out there and there are podcasts out there and they can be helpful, but you're not going to learn it just by doing that. You're going to have to get in there and do it. Yeah.
And be uncomfortable. Yeah. It's definitely learning how to feel uncomfortable and sort of also give up the like, I just want people to like me kind of vibe.
Yeah, no. Yeah, you can't go into it. I mean, you can't go into it with I just want people to like me, because it's funny, because I feel like my observation of people is that they will ask for the easy thing. Like, I want you to just say yes to me with everything I ask. But then when you do that and it hurts them or makes things more difficult for them, then they're mad at you about it. And it's like, okay, well, you can't win either way. And I have found in my experience, you don't have to agree with everyone, but if you're direct and respectful, they will appreciate that, okay, you disagree with them and you've explained why, as long as you're not playing any games about it. And that's where I find my, like, having grown up in New York State with two parents who grew up in the Bronx, like, very direct, right up front and kind of cut to the chase. And I've had to soften that a little bit being in the Midwest as long as I have been, but that's where I find that's really valuable. You know, I think there's, and this is a whole other topic we could get into, but there's all this talk in the workplace now about being a family or like, you know, it's sort of this sort of more, I don't know quite how to describe it, but it's almost like losing sight of the fact that work is kind of ultimately a transaction. It's like transaction's a dirty word. And so it's got to be personal. And it's almost like, I've been in work environments where the expectation is we're all best friends. I have found that, you know, the value of being transactional about it is that people are clear about where they stand. If you're being clear about what your expectations are, and if you're being clear about how to do something, giving someone the proper training, then they're more or less probably going to do their job, or they're going to, you know, leave and find the job they do want. But if there's all this sort of mixing in of this, it was like this in one of the prior positions I had, where it was like everybody had to be best friends, then it's like, you can't have that conversation about somebody falling down on the job because it's you know, unfriendly or mean or whatever. And I think that's something especially women have to deal with, is this issue of, are you being mean, and are you, you know, are you being nice enough? And I'm sure I've had many moments where people thought I wasn't being nice enough. But for me, in my own heart and soul, all I care about is, am I doing right by this person? You know, it's my job to be clear about expectations, to give them space to talk about what they have to say about that, to hear them out, but also to continue to hold people accountable for the expectations that are there. And, you know, when I go into a performance conversation, I'll go in and I'll give very specific examples of, you know, this is not quite what we had in mind. This is not what we need, but let me show you what success looks like. Let me paint a picture for you. Or let me even pull out an example either of something you did before that was really good, or something somebody else did that was really good. Let me give you a clear visual of what success looks like, so you know exactly what you're aiming for. And then one of the best pieces of advice I ever heard was on the radio. There was someone, CEO, being interviewed, and he said, you got to catch them doing something right. And it's like, that to me is, you know, when you see someone doing something right, make sure you tell them so they know. Like, that's what I need. Like, that's what it looks like. The positive reinforcement is really important.
It's so funny that you talk about the family thing. I just saw something about this probably on LinkedIn where somebody was kind of criticizing that in the same way that you are, right? One of my mentors put it another way, which is, don't be loyal to your people in academia. Sometimes feel very loyal to their university. I think me still being at DePaul, there is this like sort of intention, personalism, like mission, and like sort of thinking about it as a family, but it is still an organization that's a nonprofit that has a bottom line and has, you know, and I think a lot of academics don't like to hop around a lot because sometimes they feel loyal and like a sense of belonging at the institution that they're in. But the flip side of that is that the institution, I mean, this is very like meta sociological, but like, are institutions then loyal to people? Like,
No, right. The definition of an institution, what makes an institution is that it doesn't matter who the specific people are.
Right, exactly.
Will be there and be the same no matter what. And you know, and it's such an important moment too, and how, you know, folks are talking about their workplaces, especially after the pandemic, where there was all of this reexamination of what you want and what you need and what's important in your life, as we were surrounded by all of this death and this fear. And I think it's, you know, you could be loyal to your job while you're at your job, but it doesn't mean, it's not like medieval loyalty where you're going to fall down the sword for them. You know what I mean? You're not gonna, it's like, you know, I'm here to like do my job and do it really well and like serve the mission of this unit. And then when it's not acknowledging my own value or creating a safe workspace or whatever it is, it's okay to leave. And it's unfortunate, but I feel like those kinds of drastic measures, like getting up and leaving, often that's the only way they learn there's actually a problem. Because if you're there, and you should talk about things being a problem when there's a problem, I really believe in that. I know it's hard to do that. So sometimes maybe you have to be careful or strategic or pick your moment. But if you're there and you're telling them it's a problem and you're still there 3 years later, like they're, they don't get it.
Which leads brilliantly into another topic I wanted to talk to you about. You and I had dinner a few months ago and you were talking about, super excited about this new position. And you told me that you, when you were interviewing, that you negotiated for the first time ever. And I would love, I know negotiation is something that I think, especially as women, we, I mean, I remember trying to negotiate for the job, like when I was taking the job at DePaul and being, feeling weird about it, but like, I needed to do it for the women, you know, this is like a feminist sort of value kind of thing. And I did, I tried to negotiate but I think it's super uncomfortable. And I just want to, I would love for you to reflect a little bit on, like, because you were so excited that you had done that. And I just want to, I would love to hear a little bit about your perspective on that and sort of how you got there, like how you made, like how you got that courage and.
Negotiation is something that I've always been really timid about, unsure about it. A big part of it is I don't know how to do it. And it's one of those things. It's like, you don't know how to do it until you've done it a few times. Like, you don't get to watch other people do it. You don't get to, you know, it. And there's so much information asymmetry. There's so much you don't know. Like, you know, I've often faced like, I don't know how much they budgeted for this job. I don't know how much the last person had in it. And I've also had, you know, we talked earlier about me being in positions where I was growing something or it was, you know, launching something. So I was the first person to occupy that position. So when they created it, they had no idea how big it would grow. And so, and I didn't know how to think about incorporating that piece into the negotiation of like, hey, even just to say in a negotiation, are you open to reclassifying this position in a year if X, Y, and Z happens? So those pieces aside from money that are also part of the negotiation. So, you know, I've read about negotiation and I've talked with people about negotiation. Certainly when I was a career counselor, I would talk with people about it. I felt much more confident encouraging somebody else to do it and walking them through how to do it than I actually felt doing it myself. This time around, it was, you know, there had been a couple of jobs where I had like tried and you sort of get the thing where like, you know, the HR people know you're going to come and say something and they're ready with their no. And, you know, I just kind of didn't try hard enough or try to, you know, a big part of it is you have to negotiate with the person who has the power to say yes. Don't waste your time with the person who can only say no to you. It may be that the HR rep, they're not empowered to offer anything more, but there's a possibility to get more if you talk to the right person and make the right case to them. So that's the first thing that I certainly never really got down. Like, I'd always talk to the HR person. But yeah, this time around, I was talking to quite a few of my friends about it and getting some good advice on it. And part of why I think I was able to be successful was that I, you know, I was working my network. You know, I had a group of people who were also at the university who, you know, they just knew things and they were able to, you know, encourage me in ways that bolstered up my confidence. And then when it came down to it, they had offered me a certain amount of money and my sort of range, it was about, first it was about 5,000 away from my range, and then it was about 2,000 away from my range. And I was talking to a friend of mine about it, a white man who has always been very confident and very, you know, comfortable with these kinds of conversations. And I was talking to him on the phone, and I was like, oh, well, you know, maybe 5,000 isn't that much. And he said, well, I think it is. And honestly, the fact that a white man who's comfortable with this thought that that was, that changed my mind. I was like, if you think this is a lot, maybe it is a lot. Like, and I didn't even have that perspective. Like, what is a lot, right? How do you even know what is a lot?
Right.
And because it's relative, right? Is it like there's a $5,000 separation in a budget that only has $2,000 worth of wiggle room versus $20,000 worth of wiggle room? Like those are two very different scenarios. So he was telling me, he'd given me this little technique, which was, hey, you know, I always put an Excel spreadsheet together. I type in the numbers. And the thing he told me was, I think about what that difference is between what I want and what they're offering. And I calculate out in the spreadsheet how much of a difference that's going to make over 20 years. So if you're assuming a 3% cost of living adjustment every year or a raise at 3 or 4% every year, type that into the spreadsheet and see what the value is over 20 years. And I thought, oh, this is amazing. Like this, yes, that's brilliant. Yes. So that night I got on Excel, I typed it all out. And then when I saw the difference, you know, 5,000 difference over 20 years at like a 3% raise is, I think it's like over $100,000. It's like a lot. And then 2,000, you know, that difference is about $50,000. I put those numbers in and then I thought, no, I want that. I want that. I am not willing to walk away without that. When I saw what it meant in real money terms over a long period of time, then it made a difference to me as far as my feeling of this is a valuable thing to fight for. So that was the big difference for me. And I'm glad I did it because, you know, very soon after starting my position, a crucial person on my team went on leave. And so the job got bigger and I wound up having to do a lot more. And of course, at that point, you can't go back and say, well, can I get paid more? Like, you're there in the job and you're getting paid what you're getting paid. So that's something else that I have tried to keep in mind and also encourage people to do is like, don't just think about the job right now. Think about how big it's going to be in a couple of years. And are you in a situation? Because I feel like I have found myself in these situations where I started out in a job that was conceptualized a bit smaller than what it actually wound up being and what it grew to be in, you know, a matter of 2 or 3 years. You know, when I started in law school, they were expecting 30 students coming in. And then the following year, there was like 45 or 50 students in it. Program grew really big, really fast. The next job I had was launching a research center, being the first sort of head administrator in that center. It started out with 8 people. By the time I left a few years later, it was like 25 people. You know, it's a whole different sort of ball game when something grows really quickly. And I feel like if you're not careful, you can get shortchanged when that growth is happening.
Right. And it's like that thing, if you do that, then the only recourse is to change jobs or to like go on, like to try to get a counter offer, so to speak, you know, if that's even available. But in other words, to like sort of demonstrate, because basically you're like taking on more and more, becomes a bigger project. But then if you haven't thought ahead of time about how to like you said, like, are you open to reclassifying my job, you know, and having that in the offer letter? Or if you're just, and then you take on more and more and more, but you're not getting compensated for it, like you're kind of stuck.
Yeah. Right? And they're getting used to you taking on more without being, so they think it's normal and appropriate and right. And I'm not saying that's the fault of the person who takes on more. That's not what I'm saying here. Yeah. I'm just saying you can get stuck in a rut where you almost have like nowhere to go to make your argument.
Right. This is also interesting, just like intersecting with what we were just talking about being loyal. Because I think then some of the, like, be a team player, take a little bit more for everyone, like that kind of pulls on. And I think in the way that you were saying, the same way that you were saying that, like, operations and like sort of taken care of is gendered, I think that kind of connection, familial, like loyalty is also gendered. Like, I think women are more likely to be like, oh yeah, I'll just take that on, especially in nonprofits or especially in universities where you're like, oh, this is for the students.
Yes. Or this is for this mission that's really important.
Exactly.
And yes. And there, I think there's also that element of, we maybe touched on it earlier, of like, is there something dirty to saying you should pay me more money for me doing more work? And there's not at all, but it's hard, you know, again, it's sort of pulling you, it's sort of a transactional way of thinking about it. Like, I'm doing X amount of work for you and you were paying me Y dollars and now I'm doing X times 2 and you're still only paying me Y dollars. This math doesn't work out. I think for a lot of people that feels cold or calculated, or like you're uncommitted or like you don't really believe in the work you're doing. You're not, you know, and that's all hogwash. You can believe in what you're doing and also believe in your own value.
Yeah,
and also believe that you are worth, you know, you're providing a lot of value and they should compensate you for that.
Yeah. No, and I think, you know, and you and I have talked about this too, in terms of women really being able to own that value and feel like that they, if they're like demonstrating their value and talking about their value and having those kinds of uncomfortable sometimes conversations with their managers about their value, it feels like you're bragging or like you're, to put it in my like home, you know, my Kentucky like sort of parlance, it would be like, you're too big for your britches.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's like, how do we get out of that? Or how do we get the courage, right? You speak up for ourselves in these settings that undervalue us.
Yes.
And actually it works for them that we undervalue ourselves.
Yeah. And for me, one of the things I learned in my most recent negotiation was slow down. Like, you might be excited about the job and they might offer it at an amount that is acceptable to you, but maybe not necessarily what we want. That doesn't mean you have to accept it right there. Take the time to think, take the time to talk to people. Take the time to think about what are the range of things you would want. One of the best pieces of advice I read in a book on negotiation was about thinking of broadening the pie. Like, it's not just about the money. There are other things you might want to negotiate. So it might be, in this day and age, negotiating your hybrid schedule or a remote schedule, you know, negotiating your work schedule. Like, is it going to be a straight up 8 to 5 or 9 to 5? Or do you maybe want to start earlier and end earlier for a variety of reasons? Negotiating your vacation time, negotiating what your responsibilities are going to be, what kind of support you can have. Like, you could bring up in these conversations, I had brought up, like, are you thinking about reclassifying the position? you know, given certain parameters. I just wanted to start that conversation. I wanted it to be on the radar of like, this is a big job. It's a big deal. And, you know, I provided a why. You know, for me, it was I'm looking for something to stay in for long term. And, you know, I want it to be sustainable for me as well as, you know, vice versa. But there's a variety of things that you could talk through. And I think it's important to think about what all those different things are. And it doesn't have to be just about money, though that's also really important. And so that was one of the best things I'd ever read. Like, think very broadly about all the different kinds of things you
want. Right. Yeah. And really put it all on the table and don't be afraid to ask.
Right.
Right. Like if they've offered you, that's the other mistake I think people make sometimes is like, oh, I'm so grateful that they're actually offering me the job. I'll just take what they gave me or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think we fall into that trap too.
The other thing I'm glad I did this and I would encourage everyone to do it. I think it's important to talk to lots of people. You don't have to share the details of the situation per se, but for me, part of it was talking with someone who just had some, you know, inside information and, you know, understood sort of generally what the budget was. And so it was like, okay, now I have a frame of reference where I know whether this is totally off base. So I think that's a lot of the fear. And it gets back to that information asymmetry. Like, I don't know what they budgeted for this. I don't know what they paid the last person. I don't, you know, I still don't know what they paid the person before me. I certainly don't know that. But it's like, how do I even know whether this is within the realm of appropriate or totally off base and, you know, would be kind of even embarrassing to ask for that amount. If you talk to lots of people and you kind of work your network and, you know, build that community, your professional community, and you have lots of people to talk to, you can get all this really interesting information that can help bolster your own confidence about, is this an appropriate ask or not? Is this something anyone's ever done before? Like, I've talked with my brother. He's been working in nonprofits his whole life in membership, and now he's an executive director. And he was talking to me once about negotiating getting a car paid for. And like, he works in nonprofits. Like, these are not, but you know, if you're at the executive director level, that's appropriate apparently. So,
So you would only know that if you had talked to a lot of people.
Exactly. The network is so important. And don't be afraid to have those conversations, and obviously only share what you're comfortable sharing, but you know, getting any information is much better than just being completely in the dark and not knowing anything.
Yeah. I think it's also going to be interesting too, as more and more, I think Colorado is one state that is now requiring in job postings for there to be a expected salary band. And so when I look at a lot of remote jobs, or I'm working with clients who are looking at, you know, different jobs or whatever, now there's a salary band, you know, like where it'll say, this is what this job pays from low to high. And I think that addresses a little bit of the information asymmetry that you were talking about.
But
I still think negotiation, there's some, I read on LinkedIn, some people were like, oh, that's just going to make negotiation go away. But I'm like,
No, because it depends on what you're looking at, but the ranges can be quite broad.
They can.
You know, Northwestern has just recently started posting their salary ranges for each job. Sometimes that range is like $40,000 or $50,000. Like sometimes it's $5,000 and sometimes it's $50,000. So you still have to negotiate because you have to sort of make your justification for why you want the higher end. And the thing that I love about posting the salaries is that even if you're not looking for jobs in that company, it's helpful as a research tool. Like for you can go and say, this is the qualifications you have to have. This is the background and experience you have to have. These are the job duties. It's all like, this is very similar to what you have posted that I've just been offered. So this is where I'm getting that information from.
Yeah. It makes it a lot easier to do that kind of comparative research, which is so useful when you're trying to figure out like, what is this competitive? Is it not competitive and all that?
Right.
So thank you so much. This was so much fun.
And thank you. I had a great time. I feel like I keep talking for 2 hours.
Well, that's what happens when we go out anyway. This is going to be amazing for my listeners. I think it's so great to talk to somebody who is in the kind of position that you're in, is in nonprofits, is like really thoughtful about the different kind of career choices that you've made. And there's like that kind of growth mindset about just reading constantly, understanding like, okay, I'm going to learn about negotiation this time when I apply for this job. I'm just going to like figure that out and get, you know, I think that kind of attitude and perspective is going to be incredibly useful. So I really appreciate your time.
I think it's never too late to learn how to do something. So thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
It's been great and fantastic. And I love your podcast.
As we wrap up our conversation with Susan, I am wanting to reflect some on the interview and some of the things that I learned in the discussion. And one of those is about really knowing yourself and trusting yourself when you are making a decision or going down a path that deviates from the one that you started on. In other words, Susan went to school to get her PhD because she loved learning. But she realized in the middle of her PhD that being a professor wasn't what she wanted to do. But instead of feeling stuck and, oh my gosh, I did the wrong thing and this and that, like she really leaned into the idea that she could finish her degree, but then work at a university or do other kinds of careers that might be better suited for her and her personality. And I was impressed with this when I worked with her, but I also was impressed with this on the interview about how much she really, really owned what her preferences were. And how she didn't beat up on herself or, you know, wasn't hard on herself for really liking what she liked to do and not sort of climbing the ladder. I've also always been impressed with Susan's ability to just go out there and get the next job, right? As soon as she starts feeling like the position is not right for her anymore, she starts looking. And in some cases, she's applying internally. And in other cases, she's looking at other organizations that are similar, right? So she has had a career in higher education. The way this might apply to you is you may have had a career in nonprofits, right? And it may be that you're changing positions and roles as you switch, but she stayed in that same industry, but was never afraid to go and look for a new job if she felt like her current job wasn't serving her needs or wasn't challenging her enough or wasn't quite the right fit. Because, you know, sometimes you can't know until you're in something what it's going to be like. And I think that is an important lesson for us all to learn, that it's possible to just change your mind after 2 or 3 years and just move to another position. Finally, I wanted to touch on this part of the interview where we talked about negotiation. One of the most empowering moments in that interview was when she talks about how she negotiated for the very first time. And she's changed jobs quite a number of times. And I think this is the first time that she was just like, you know what? I'm doing this. I am asking for what I know is a competitive salary. She did a ton of networking. She figured out what the possible salary ranges were. And I think the lesson here is like information is power, and especially in negotiating for salary. It's also a little bit of a mindset game, right? Like if it's, you know, a couple thousand dollars, you might say, oh, well, do I really need to negotiate? Maybe I don't. But as she explained, when you really take into account the compounded effect of many, many years of working at a certain salary level, that actually adds up to serious money over the course of a career. I was really impressed with how she advocated for herself, advocated for her experience, and really set the stage for herself in whatever she decides she's going to progress in next. If this interview resonated with you, and especially if you're interested in support on your next best career move, doing a lateral move within your organization, or even if you're thinking about best steps in a negotiation scenario, how to ask for a raise, if you would like support, I would love to talk to you in a voice your value call, absolutely free. Just to get a sense of what you're going through, and I can help you
with whatever career situation that you're presented with. And you'll walk away with more clarity, with some aha moments, and really being able to lean into the confidence that you'll gain from knowing your value, understanding that it's normal to feel a little fearful or a little scared or a little tentative about making a career move, negotiating for yourself, standing up for yourself, but that ultimately you're doing it for you. You're trusting yourself. If I can support you in any way, I would love you to sign up for a free 30-minute call. My calendar is linked in the show notes, or you can just simply go to voiceyourvaluecall.com and sign up for one of the spots. I have them every week, and I would love to talk to you. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I will see you next week.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Her Leading Story. If you love this episode, please help me reach more women by leaving a review wherever you're listening. Thank you so much for being here, and I'll see you next week.
This has been an Awkward Sage production.